it gets very interesting, and interest is the key to energy. Tireless energy is aroused. In one who has aroused energy, unworldly rapture aroused. Energy is piti. Piti is energy. The horse is piti. Movement. In one who is rapturous, so that the consciousness is now moving from objects to being aware of energy flows. It's on more subtle. You're letting go of subject to object, and there is now more aware of like the flowing of cause and effect, which is called teaching. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. So if there's not an identification, or if there isn't any emotion, any of the motives of cause and effect are not of like a painful nature, you've already done all that. And so you're just aware of the dancing movement of energy, inner, outer, breathe in, the world, who's breathing in, you are the world, breathe out, who's breathing out, you are the world. And just interpenetrative energy of dancing blissfulness, the deity is dancing, as sometimes called. Then there is a sense of absolute calm in the center of the movement. There is a sense of like the eye of the hurricane, kind of this absolute calm quality, which is called prasadi, tranquility. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, and so as you focus more and more on just being present with that tranquility and the peacefulness and the pleasure of that, the contentment, it should be more contentment, then concentration becomes deeper, then the mind becomes even more concentrated in the present moment. And when concentration develops, then there is less attachment, less of an identity of self or other, because it becomes broader and broader, and there's like letting go of the differentiation between self and other, and so that it goes to form, formless realm. Then there is looking closely on with equanimity at the mind. This is how the four foundations of mindfulness develop and cultivate to fulfill the seven enlightenment factors in the middle length saying. That's just a nice little quote. So that's both in the Theravada and in the Vajrayana. The same teaching is slightly different way of looking at it. So then in the top cube, see that four-sided cube that I was pointing at just below all the umbrellas? That's the Eightfold Path. Each corner is one step of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the basis of most of the teaching of how most people understand Buddhism. The first point of the Eightfold Path is called right view. And the symbol for that in the Tibetan is also in the mantle offering the banner of victory. It symbolizes right view. And right view is the Four Noble Truths. First Noble Truth is there is dissatisfaction. Second one is there is cause for dissatisfaction. The third one is there is cessation of dissatisfaction. And the last one is there's something you can do. There is a way to experience that cessation. There's basically there's something you can do. There's something that you can actually do. There is a ladder right out if you want to use it. The banner of victory is called the splendid body of the victor becomes the object of complete victory in all directions. His precious top ornament liberates from all existences. The various folds of silk represent his not resting in peace. It is a sign of victory over all disagreements, disharmoniousness, or hindrances. Victory of knowledge over ignorance. Banner of victory represents victory of knowledge over ignorance. It's like the pennant that would be placed after a war or a skirmish of this side won. You know, banner of victory, that's what it is. This is the victory of knowledge over ignorance. That's what it means. Right understanding, right view. Permanent happiness, victory in all directions. Right thought is an umbrella. And right thought is basically thought that is free of desire, of raga, ill will, and of harm, wishing harm. And the image of that is an umbrella. Because it's not caught up in the heat or the sleet or the... You know, it's a protection from those states. Right thought. So, right thought, right intention. And the image is from the head of the victor comes a cool, excellent shade. And you can see the umbrella here, which represents right thought again in another way. So that right thought in terms of the whole world here, this umbrella. Cool, excellent shade which protects us. He is like an object that is well supported through the 100 powers of the threefold confidence of the beings to be attained. He is quite surrounded by the folds of compassion. This is very Tibetan kind of language, and I'm not going to try to describe it all. I'm just going to read it to you. You can take it in your unconscious. I don't care if you get it or not at the moment. Protect from the heat of the conflicting emotions, from the kleshas. It represents faith in the triple gem, spiritual confidence. And faith in the triple gem means faith in Buddha, faith in Dharma, faith in Sangha, which would mean faith in acting without being overwhelmed by sensuality, like the feeling, holding the consciousness free of over sensual involvement, from free from ill will and free from the desire to harm self or others. Respect. So that would be that way. The conch shell represents right speech. The conch shell is right speech has four categories. The first category has to do with not purposefully leaving something out or putting something in that is contrary to what you actually know. And that is basically lying. That's what lying is, isn't it? Changing reality when you're talking. Purposely leaving something out or putting something in. That's the first kind. And the second one is to demonize, to collect evidence about against somebody and then go and just hardly wait to tell somebody else about it, you know, to demonize events or people or circumstances. Not gossip, demonize. Actually cause actual really hard feelings, you know, like pick someone out and tell you, and like that you really attack somebody with your language, much more than gossip. And the next one is harsh speech. It's called harsh speech. Oh, them. They're closer. Thought that was a strange cricket. Harsh speech. And the word is actually hatchet. Hatchet speech. Where you're using language to actually create schisms and to like... to cause, like, actually attack. Demonizing is where you go and you talk about somebody to somebody else, but you do it purposefully to demonize. You know, like when you hear a lot of that rhetoric, when there's like a desire to have a war, and you hear people described, and you hear all of the worst possibilities, and then there isn't any sense in them being like fathers or mothers or, you know, having children or, you know. Like in probably the most startling example for most of us is in the Nazi propaganda about Jews, how they were called rats, and you know, you used to have this footage in movies of rats running out of slums, and this kind of incredible descriptions that went along with that. And so like that, that was demonizing. It's not gossip. Gossip is something altogether different. And neither is it just harsh speech. Harsh speech is when you're actually, you know, hatching somebody directly. You never do anything right, do you? That's harsh speech. And the fourth kind of speech is gossip, which they call dead speech. Speech that doesn't have any creative power. It just deadens the energy. The word translates, that's used in Pali, translates purpose to pollard. We know what pollard is. It's like when an animal casts its horns, so he doesn't have, you know, after a deer has grown these splendid antlers, because he's very fertile, he's going to go and challenge all the other deer in the woods, and then that's finished, that act is done. They've, you know, fertilized another egg for another year, and, you know, she's going to go off and do the pregnancy thing, and he's going to go off. He doesn't want to get caught in the tree, so he casts the antlers, right? And he doesn't have any sperm that's, like, very live at that point. That's called pollard. Pollard. And it's also applied to, you said, you know, it's applied to gardening or something, isn't it? There's when you cut a fruit tree back because you're pruning it, it's called pollard. Or pole. Sometimes pole. Hmm? Pollard, yeah. So, yeah, that's a nice pole. And that's the same word that actually comes from Pali in Sanskrit, that word in English. And it's the same word, and that's what gossip is, basically. Language without life giving property. Need, huh? And that's what gossip is. It's a deadening language, using speech in a deadening way. So those are four kinds of false speech, and the representation of that is the conch shell. Immaculate self-made object, because, you know, the shell is actually made from the sea of samsara by the animal as a refuge. And that's what you have to do with speech. You have to make it into a refuge for the benefit of all beings. It's beautiful, isn't it? Beautiful imagery. And the lines running around to the right, like a perfectly pure staircase, whatever comes into contact with the Dharma sound of the great vehicle is linked to the wholesome. To actually use language for refuge, for the benefit of all beings. Nice. Nice image. The vase represents right action. From the neck of the vase, the streaming of the inexhaustible heavenly treasure, and with the continuous inexhaustible dance of cause and effect, no matter what you do, there's always this inexhaustible amount of things still to come. Inexhaustible treasure of reaping all past desires. Just think how many things you've wished for just in this life. From the time you were born, how many things have you wished for? 1 in 10? Would you say? Okay. Imagine all of them are actually going to arrive. From every day, all the way back. Can you imagine? Every one of them are actually going to come. Seeds of karma are waiting to ripen as soon as the circumstances are ripe. Then imagine everybody else wishing. Then how about beetles? I always like picking on beetles because there's more of them than there are humans, so it should be called beetle earth. And then how about horses, cows, pigs, donkeys, you know, all the different beings, angels. Then how about your parents? How about your grandparents? So you think there's like a lot of wishes, you know? So there's like continuously pouring over this. Continuous, like the desires of the past are continuously being, continuously coming into existence and dissolving. Right? They're coming over the edge and dissolving in the present moment. Continuous, but continuous reaping of desires. The inexhaustible heavenly treasure. The realm of desires, our realm, is represented by the rim. Whatever you wish for, you're going to get. Cause and effect is real. A wish is an action of the mind. It bears fruit. And then the realm of form, That is to say, emotional realm is represented by the belly and the contents, the swirling energy within that's going to come into being, like the Dead Sea thing, remember I was talking about Bensi? That's like the belly of it. And the formless realm by the empty space. The space which is the what gives any cause its power, the space. The decorations correspond to the intricate ongoing dance between samsara and nirvana, that they're the same place, just depends, you know, which way you look at. I just one teacher once, and he was a wonderful teacher, he was Tibetan, and he was a wonderful teacher, and it was really great, and somebody would say to him, saying to him, you know, I don't know how you can teach so well to Westerners. And he looked at them for a while, really quizzical, and he said, Eastern mind? Western mind. The inexhaustible Dharma treasure. That everything is like continuously moving and turning. It doesn't matter what culture, what era, what realm. That will never stop. But ongoing dance, cause and effect. So this is the vase, and its teaching represents right action. Because cause and effect is real, how to use it? How to use it? And then basically it has to do with acting in harmony with all that is. And so that means non-harm, not causing prana to fall or not killing and harming. Dina adana, not taking what isn't freely given. I used to think that would take care of about 2/3 of my Christmas presents right there. But you know how cynical I can be. And kamai sum nichachara, which basically means not swooning into sensuality. Those are the three most important. Not swooning into pleasure, which also I think all three of those have to do where your own sense of yourself becomes more important than the environment. Would you see that? Do you think that's true? Like causing harm here and there is not seeing yourself as part of a whole. And taking what isn't freely given or not taking what is freely given is also not seeing yourself as part of the whole. And unwholesome sensuality is also not seeing yourself as part of the whole. So it seems to me that all three of those have to do with not trying to impose your view on the whole world, or being able to act in harmony, and that's right action. And what I call equal density, both sides of the skin. And the next is the wheel, again appearing, but this time in the Eightfold Path, and it represents here right livelihood, well-fashioned from the clear, genuine, pure gold of the two collections of merit and rank. The two collections that you have to get, one is sila and the other is insight. First of all, you have to have a really good base, and then you have to see clearly. You have to think you have the right to see, and then you have to have eyes to see. So they're called the two accumulations in all the schools of Buddhism. And right livelihood, basically, I love the way my teacher, my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche, described it many years ago, is getting the most for the least. But right livelihood is getting the most from it. So right livelihood has to do with. Is that off? Because it's awfully hot in here.
Looks like
it's hot. Yeah. Right livelihood Right livelihood is basically when one uses the energy of the four elements for the benefit of all beings. So the right livelihood actually is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Right livelihood is basically becoming Chenrezig. That's what Chenrezig represents. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. And then the lotus, which represents right effort. I've already talked about that. Its color is unsullied and beautiful. The right effort is you've already talked about that also, is like when you see the unwholesome, when you see the possibility, when you see the unwholesome, drop it. But first one usually quoted is, when you see the possibility of the unwholesome, avoid it. When you see the unwholesome that is present, drop it. When you see the wholesome mind state that is present, name it, cultivate it. When you see that there is no wholesome present, seed it, develop it. That's right effort. And then, so that that's the lotus. That's how the lotus is able to grow from the mud to the light. There is no other way to grow from the mud to the light except through right effort, except going in the right direction. And then the next one is right mindfulness, and this is the endless knot. The symbol is the endless knot, which has the swastika in its center. Swastika. Which is the net of all continuity. It is the outstanding jewel of the essence of the inexhaustible treasure. The earliest form of the swastika was two nagas, two snakes interwoven. When you're meditating, sometimes you feel spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. If you read Christianity or you read I give you the keys to the kingdom, that you can loose what shall be loose, counterclockwise, and bind what shall be bound, clockwise. The swastika is the cross of the four energies, the four elements in the center point of space, and it's either going to be turning clockwise or counterclockwise, and it's fiery to represent the transcendent wisdom. Right? So if this was a fiery cross and it was spinning this way, which way would the flame go? Go down this way, right? So what's that? A swastika, right? It's a flame turning. Right? And if it was spinning this way, which way would the flame go? This way, right? Do you understand? So you see the swastika on Buddha is usually you find both. But usually here it's counterclockwise, and on the hands and feet and so forth, in different places it would be turning different ways. The two swastikas in perfect balance, which creates another state, is the eight-foot wheel. What's going on? Mm-hmm. The endless knot as well, two snakes, the interdependence, the way in which reality exists, no beginning, no end. The non-duality of profound clarity and emptiness. And how do you get to that? And this is according to the Buddha too, and this is nice because this is taking us almost full circle to what I taught the first night we were here. The first one is when you see something unwholesome, see what is wholesome in it. That's the first thing. Is that good? Second thing, when you see something that's unwholesome, find something wholesome in it. That's the second. There are five of these. This is how you develop the balance of loosening and binding and the two nagas in total balance so that you can pass beyond duality. And the third thing that happens is it, once you have seen the unwholesome and you can allow yourself to see the wholesome in it, develop both so you can hold either one equally. Now that's fun. So the fourth one, of course, is once you can see the wholesome and you can find the unwholesome in it, what do? You develop them both equally. So you could go either way. I could see, you could see equally. This is so much fun. And the fifth one is quite neat, and apparently only a Buddha can do it, is hold both the wholesome and the unwholesome with equal interest in your mind. Because that would be moving beyond duality, wouldn't it? Which would definitely be right mindfulness, wouldn't it? Moving beyond all duality, wouldn't it? So the endless not. And the last right concentration, golden fish, they arise out of the sea of the eyes of the omniscient one. And now this is the non-dual wisdom of clarity and emptiness. With a total awareness. So that is the eye, now the ocean of totality with eyes, with clarity and emptiness together. Non-dual. It's called the unexplainable, ineffable, the non-definable state. And it's the golden fish. They arise out of the sea of the eyes of the omniscient one and move in the water of benefit for others. The benefit consists of the combination of method and wisdom. The sweep of the fins of their activities is great. Two fish represent the two sacred rivers originally of the Ganges and the Yamuna in the Hindu tradition, which, as you know, the Buddha was a Hindu. Here, this is the total removal of the darkness of ignorance and the non-dual wisdom of total awakening. So that's called right wisdom. Right concentration. That's what a Buddha looks at the world like. I too use concepts, but I'm not fooled by it because the concentration is total. And it's like fish. So that's the Eightfold Path. Golden fish, the two fish. So that is the Eightfold Path. So that's the four sides of the four points of the cube. Ta-da-da. Right there. One, two, three, four, five. So this is the here, which is where the now you can actually see the image of the Buddha here. And this is the Eightfold Path, and this is usually where the relics are actually held, stored in the tube above them. And then after this is the result. This is the 10 knowledges of 10 powers of a Buddha and the 3 knowledges of a Buddha. And then this is the umbrella. Which now that is of benefit to the entire world. And then this is like the space, consciousness, and the activity for the benefit of all beings. Super. Any questions, answers, comments, please? It's a little more dry this afternoon than I meant to be. I hope you did all right with that. You tied up a few loose ends.
Also the
It's very different. It's very different. So what you do is when you notice you want something, you image energy, whatever energy you want to, or light or whatever, above your head, and you just offer that wish. You say, I would like this, please take care of it. And now drop it and pay attention with what's present, practice kindness with what's present. So whenever it comes up, you just send it into the order disk. Get on with your work. Get on with accepting the wishes you've already received that you've forgotten you wish for.
Yeah.
Clear the inbox. Beautiful. Thank you. What a beautiful question. First thing I would like to... Did you ask what you want to...
Yeah.
Right. Because you can't see any results from a lot of time, after 20 or 30 years. First thing I would like to say to you is that don't underestimate the power of the actions we perform when we're learning how to be compassionate. That the intention for compassion is itself very powerful. And I do not in any way mean to judge that because an action is not totally compassionate is no reason to stop performing it. It might be a reason to aspire to become more compassionate. So if your life is involved with the work that is about altruism, like, do not criticize it unduly. But if you feel that there is a frustration in it, neither do you allow yourself to turn to bitterness with that, because you do want to practice kindness. So then maybe what you want to do is, first of all, practice some kindness toward yourself. Does that make sense to you? Because maybe you actually need to, like, back away from your work however you can, or the intent you have for your work, maybe that's what you need to back away. And pose the question of, have I lost the joy of giving, or am I putting too much attention in what I want to receive? You know? That's, for example, how your motive has changed without you knowing. That would be my first suggestion, that quite often over 20 years our motives change and we don't notice that, because we have different motives at different ages. I've noticed several drifting through in the 60 odd years I've been around, and I'm sure others will have, you know, have a similar thing to say. You notice different motives at different ages. So maybe what has happened is that the job has is no longer manifesting what you thought it did when you started, maybe because you have shifted your view of how that, what kind of influence you were going to have in that job. Is that one possibility? Maybe what has changed is your view of what you're going to, what influence you're going to have in that job. So then you have to be honest and kind with that. That doesn't mean that your previous aspiration wasn't attained, or that there aren't many people who are very grateful that you were their teacher, or you were their social worker, or you were their meditation teacher, or you were their therapist. You know? It doesn't mean that that was not successful, but when there is a personal change, quite often we can tend to trash everything that went before, because we have this magnificent, wonderful ego structure that assumes that how I feel right now is how I have always felt. So now I've changed my view, I want something different from the job, therefore I have always been misled. I'll burn all the rest, all the previous years of my life. Which, you know, like, I've watched myself do that more than once, and finally I got bored with it. I would recommend you get bored with it easily, quickly. It's not a lot to be said for that state of mind. So first of all, examine yourself. And don't examine yourself with anger or think of feeling it. If you're starting to feel kind of tired, is that sort of where your question was going? Or that the effect that you thought you were going to have isn't what you're having? That's what I was picking up from your question. That what one thinks one is doing might not be what one is doing? Because it came from... And I was speaking directly about anger at that point, if you remember. Because anger is often put up as righteous. In fact, the two words go together quite often, righteous anger, which I find very confusing myself. That's not my experience of anger, it's not that it's righteous. What's the real meaning of the word righteous? It might be ego-clinging righteous, but not. It's one view going to impose over all other views because of the way that one view feels. So I find that I have learned not to like go there with that. So I was speaking particularly in terms of that. By the same token, first of all, I'm saying that it would be useful to examine your own, what it is you want, because maybe your motives have changed, which is very likely. And then the second thing is, it could be that, you know, in the beginning we go out and we need to work in the world to see what is possible. And the world eventually teaches us what isn't possible. And first we learn what is possible, and slowly that begins to be the world's gift to us is what isn't possible. So that brings us to that point of spiritual practice, that brings us to our knees where we know what we can't do. So some of us meet that with a sense of bitterness or defeat or a feeling of failure. But you could also take that motive of like, now I'm starting to learn what isn't possible. Okay, how do I find the authority, that because it's not possible, because I don't have the power. So how do I turn what isn't possible into the gateway to that place where all things are possible? And that feeling of despair, because there is a kind of despair to that feeling of what's not possible, is very much, very precious. That is Guru. That is the only place where the doorway opens to going beyond self. Everything else is still my sense of Guru. But at that point is surrender and a real calling, because one wants to know how could it be possible, that opens into the spiritual realm. There's nothing else that does it. So again, first of all, examine yourself, and secondly, examine what might be beyond yourself. But don't ever doubt, just because, you know, like I really love, you know, one of the things that gives me so much comfort is the Buddha saying that everybody wasn't awakened is crazy. Yeah, it gives me so much comfort. Oh, is it fully awakened? It's crazy. That just gives me so much comfort. It just gives me so much comfort. And then it's very clear that I don't know it all. I'm not awakened. And that there is something saner than I. And that some being has reported that it's acceptable. So to take that which is crazy nature for me, despair, whatever it is, and use that as the place. Okay. So is that useful, my friend?
So this came in into that part of the wishing to be a leading out of the deal with your head with the limitation.
Yes. And that's exactly why in the Tibetan tradition they focus so much on for the benefit of all beings and being aware and doing precious human birth and being aware of, you know, loving kindness is done by being aware of the kindness that other people have done for you and how you can't pay them back. Compassion is done by being aware of how many people are suffering that you really love and you can't help them. It's like all built on developing a really clear sense of that despair of what you can't do, and from that comes the wishing to reach you. Whereas in the Theravadin, that same power is created by looking at the suffering. Looking at what is not self, looking at what is painful, looking at what you don't have. Like just pure insight, just boring, and just pure insight, like look at the satisfaction. Whatever you desire is a lot. It's not going to satisfy. So they're both working the same way in the Theravada, and they don't call it bodhicitta. They don't call it the desire to awaken for the benefit of all people. That does not mean that that isn't a desire of some person who's out there in the forest. They might very well be like three times the bodhicitta prayer that somebody who has taken the vow 50,000 times with their lips moving, you know, in some Tibetan monastery. But that real ability to move the consciousness beyond the sense of I requires the power of desire, which requires a foundation that you really think you can't do something and then running into what you can't do. And a willingness to go beyond self. A real clear understanding that self is not the totality of the universe. So it requires despair and on your knees. explore the past, let go of the future. There's nothing you can do on your refuge. Basically means collapse. But collapse with purpose and awareness. Because you know what you're asking for and you know what you can't do. That's why you collapse. That's why. So it's like surrender rather than collapse. Oh, here's the right answer for the book, Katie. Oh, here's one for you. Right answer is left, right, center. I saw what it's about. Beautiful question. Isn't that lovely? Yeah. So you can see the value of like that right awareness, teaching yourself to see the beautiful in the unbeautiful, teaching yourself to see the unbeautiful in the beautiful. The power of that is very specific. It's probably, you know, to me, it's probably one of the greatest tools there is. It's in your daily life, you know, like that one you can do on the street corner. Like you could do that any time, and it brings your consciousness to actually be able to surrender. First of all, you're surrendering your views. It's a little mini practice of surrender. And it will develop clarity of comprehension. It will develop equanimity. It will develop the ability to really pray for what is really important in the being.
I feel I'm struggling more and more for myself. It's that it's not out there, but there's something out there. What I find most confronting, most frightening, most difficult is suffering of the people who are very, very positive. Even if you think, oh, there's something over there, I'm trying to go, walking at somebody's house, I don't know, and be there for them. But when there's someone who's standing and it's something that comes down, I can't go to be there.
And that sense of despair.
And you just want to shut down.
Yeah.
How do all that?
Is that here? Somebody breaking in, or is that a fire alarm? Do you think an arsonist has broken? Do you think we're about to die in any minute? Do you think this could be your last breath? What's important? Figuring it out, or being present with loving kindness. What's the most important thing now that you're about to die in time? Turning off. To actually take that as a surrender without turning your back on the subject or falling into your own despair. And you really need your body, don't you, to do that? You really need to focus on your body, and that's what kindness with what is. You can still do the surrender, but focus on kindness with what is. You bring yourself to the moment. You don't try to fix anything. You're aware of that wish to fix. You hold that as, I wish there was something I could do. You practice kindness with that. Sometimes it's just sitting and holding something. Sometimes it's yelling at them,
well, brush your teeth, for God's sake.
To be anything. But if you trust your heart, it will move from me. And I'm not saying that anger is valuable. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that energy is valuable. One of the stories about the, you know, the Jataka tale. Hi. Oh, that's fine. Did he look secure to you? I don't think he's very secure. Confirming. Did he feel secure to you? You'll be secure. He didn't look very secure to me. What was your last question? Isn't that interesting? What does your mind go? You ask yourself that. You ask yourself that, you know, one of the meditations that's very useful to do is meditation on impermanence. When you're standing at a curve and you see a car about to turn the corner, you could say, right now that driver could have a heart attack and lose control, that car could come right for me. How do I want to die? Sitting and talking to someone, you look at the baby blue eyes, you know, think all kinds of whatever thoughts you're thinking, who knows. And you think, this could be the last time I see this person. They could be having a massive heart attack right now. I could be about to die of some virus right now. And just do that regularly. Do that so you actually pay attention because it's true. One of the things that happens is you have a lot more joy in your life. And the times that I have spent with people who are dying, when they say it's a beautiful day, it really is. It's like, beautiful. Oh yeah. This is a nice room, they will say. It is. And there is like that immediacy of being able to taste the moment. It always brings joy. Joy for what you do have. When you're thinking about that, you would rather not think about death, that creates morbidity. But actually thinking about death, it creates a sense of joy for what is present. The most important thing at death is, you know, there are two things that rule rebirth. One is called heavy action, which I've talked about a couple of times, garuka karma, heavy action. And the other is habit. It's your habit. For most of us, it's our habits that will rule our death. So what are your habitual thoughts? Oh. Oh. Well. Okay, how do you change habitual thoughts again? Where's my notebook? I mean, it's okay being me, but I wouldn't mind to change some other lifetime. Especially when I think about adolescence. I'm not sure I want to do that again. I don't know about you, but... Yeah. You know, so habitual thoughts, so, you know. What do you want to do with that? What do you want to do with that? Well, first, one of the quick ways, to change your habitual thoughts is to just to be aware of it permanently. That if you were to make a spiritual practice a habit, that would have quite a difference in rebirthing and karma. Especially because wholesome habits are stronger than unwholesome. Praise whatever God may be. It requires fewer wholesome actions to create rebirth-linking karma than unwholesome. A nice question. Whoever it was that asked it. Well, you know, we're kind of running out of time for a break or to meditate. Do you have any more questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
You see, I'd just like to say, I started off very interested in depending on the forest and the economy. And when it came to no effect, because you might be certain local ministers and they might leave the whole game of politics or the forestry industry, and there was always something else coming along. Then my brothers in arms fell in love with girls, got married, built houses.
Out of what?
They got out of minimism into maximisation.
Mm-hmm.
And I begin to see that and it's just from, I hate to say it, but it's like that insanity that we're hitting our head against the tree instead of stepping back saying we, you know, like when we're crazy, we are the environmental destruction. We are the terrorists. We are the wolves. We are the soldiers. And like you were saying, until we end the madness in ourselves, this will always go on. Hence, I heard the Dalai Lama say the other night on TV to a bunch of international politicians and generals and that. They were saying to him, when will terrorism be? On this sphere, he went like this, you know, on this world, never. They couldn't believe that he could say that, but he had to say that because...
Is that true?
That's right. So, unless you have this big, the big view and see that you are the world. And the only way you're going to...
If it's out there, it's never going to end.
And when will it be? You know, like this is the frightening part, although it's the only hope at the same time. When will it be that there's no really sickos on the world that are terrorists? When will that be? You can clean up one generation, maybe, and then you've got this whole new lot of crazy people. And I guess when will it be is you start right now with yourself and then go out in the world with all this information, which is very engaged and very social, and live your life from this perspective. Someone harmless, harmless. So I watched three or four paradigms and generations of my own original hippies fall off and become the actual people. They still had hair, they still had the flowers, and they had the words about being peaceful and this, that, and the other, but their desire drew them back into the mechanisms of the world that were created out of madness and consumed in madness. So I guess that's what I discovered from my life before I became... I had to realise this, I just realised somehow that this was, this wasn't going to change anything. You cop a lot of flack.
That's not true.
No.
It wasn't going to change what you wanted to change. It changed, something changed. Everything is changing, but what you wanted to change was not going to change that.
Well, the way of it, wasn't going to work.
Yeah, the way you were doing it.
So I had to find
Which is more clear.
It had to find another way.
Yeah, you had to examine your position.
Yeah, I had to really see what I could really do about it.
Yeah. or as my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche said to me, it's the inner war you have to stop. That does not mean that I don't work for recycling communities or, you know, wash out plastic bags or go into department stores and say, oh, this is a really nice bag. Oh, made in China. That's too bad. You can still see the blood, can't you? Oh, well. You know, or spend my time in old age homes. I do all that. But I don't expect the world to be aligned with my views. I expect the inner war to be what I want to stop. My dislike is what I'm interested in. And what I'm doing there, I consider kindness. Interested in working on the emotion from here, from my work. And whatever I'm doing there, I consider kindness. And if I actually cause harm out there, then I would very quickly repair it, right to God. So, I mean, that's what we all have to do. We all have to be generosity. Whether we're practicing kindness or space, kindness or compassion, kindness or skill in the outer world. And in the inner world, we're continuously holding the mind to the beloved. And there is a sense of equanimity about how the beloved is acting, whether we can see it or not. That's the heart. Everything that comes. Whatever is arising is a result of that. I don't know. Not on this side of the ribbon of madness. You know. Quickly run through the crow story. They had this crow, this nice young adolescent crow. He was like, came to my bird feeder. Now, my bird feeder is a very particular bird feeder. Not that many crows come, but, you know, I get some pretty neat. I get the American goldfinch, and I get some pretty neat birds there. They're pretty glorious looking. But this crow was coming, and he was really handsome. He was young, handsome, very, and real talker. You ever heard crows? Mm-hmm. I'm used to crows talking because I spent lots of time out there, you know, in the woods. But he really talked. And when he was there, I would come out on the deck and start talking to him, and he would just like get into conversations with me. I'd say, well, here you are again. How are you? And he'd go, and so we carry on these wonderful conversations. And one time he's there, and he also was really good at cash and trash, you know. He's very good at cash and trash. That's like the bird seed, right? Trash. So he could empty the bird feeder, and really, he was really good at emptying. He could run through more bird seed than most of the other ones. And he's there one day, and he's like, he's just like talking away, and I come out. I can get quite close to him. He doesn't fly away or anything, and I'm talking about him. I'm all across the wall. I mean, really, he would like, we would imitate each other. It was a lot of fun. And I'm standing there looking at him, and I'm just like this admiration for him, because he's so young and male. You could tell he was male. You could tell. And it was like just so beautiful. Well, maybe I could tell. Or something. I don't know. But it was like wonderful. You know, that wonderful energy. And I said, aren't you just a handsome kind of guy? And he, I swear, this is actually true. He stretched one wing out. He lifted one leg and stuck it back. He stretched the other wing backwards, affixed me with his glittery crow's eye, and went, oh, like he was going, oh. Well, you know, how did that make me feel? It was wonderful. I was in love. And so he came and we talk all the time. It was really neat. And Kathy heard him talk lots of times. She can affirm for him being a really good talker. And then one time he comes about a few weeks later after this, but he's not doing cash and trash, and there's something decidedly, it is like very different. His energy is totally different. I'm out there when he's there, you know, I go out if I see him. I'm always out on the deck, and I'm out in the deck, and I'm sort of talking to him, but he's basically ignoring me. And he's like looking at the seed really carefully. He's like, you know, and then he moves that one over, and he looks at that one, and he's like he's hunting for something. So I just sort of lean back, and I just kind of watch him. He was really unusual, and he's like, he finds it. This is it. You had this communication of energy that was like superb. And you knew he found it. And it's like, Pierce. He's saying it. And he's got this one sunflower seed in his beak. And he jumps up three branches and gives it to her. He had brought her. And he's on a date. And she accepts. And it goes, energy. So he's not quite around quite so much. You know, I figure, well, okay. And then one day he comes in and he's got this bloody fledgling in his claws. And he puts it on the railing that's just underneath the first theater. It's like he's been shopping. He's got to get home with the groceries too. But he's just going to stop and have, you know, a couple of seeds on the way home, you know. Nothing much. He does want to take the groceries home, but meanwhile. So he puts this fledgling on the deck, you know, and I'm looking, and there's definitely no way that fledgling is definitely dead. There's no point in my doing any recovery or anything. This is definitely roast beef for dinner tonight, you know. I just keep out of that part of it. And he jumps up on the bird feeder, and he's doing cash and trash, because he's sort of like the old mentality. You know, I gotta, you know, he's probably thinking about taxes or whatever. And then I got to, and then a good time. There's magpie. I don't know if you know. Canadian magpie. Magpie flies over, looks down, and swoops around, begs quickly, swoops around, and sits on the edge of the house where he could see crow and groceries. Really clear. Sits there. Crow doesn't notice because he's going, oh, just one more seed, okay. And I was watching groceries. Crow. Groceries. Crow. Wait, it was brilliant. Magpie waits until crow has the seed. Crow always takes like two jumps away from the bird feeder, stands on the branch and puts one foot on the seed and then pecks it And it's obvious that Crow has like one more peck and that seed, and you can feel him about to get it, you know. There's just one more, I'm just going to get this with one more bite, right? So he's like got one bite away from having the seed in his mouth. Magpie swoops down.
Yeah.
Groceries are so soft. Crow goes, ah! Ah! Jumps down on the railing. Looks around. Looks up at me and goes, ah! Ah! Pretty cruel. So this year he was around a little bit, but he's sort of is like soul in the past. We were talking about him at lunch, saying, you know, it was one of my great affairs of my life, but it was just brief, and he did have something else to do. So. And now it doesn't mean anything to him. It's so often it's the way. I'm very grateful for your practice, for your love of Dharma, for your generosity and your hospitality inviting me. It's so wonderful to know when I'm back in Bisbee or wherever I am that you are here doing your practice. Keep me honest. I'm grateful for that. A lot of people are probably grateful that you keep me honest. I'm grateful for how you inspire me. And I'm so thankful that you invited me to come here. I hope it has been useful to you. It has been useful to me. And may all beings find freedom from suffering from our working together. I feel this extremely beautiful gold light in your heart. It spreads through your body, pours out your pores and every direction. Someone we want to pray for, just image them being washed by the light. Spread through the entire universe, and we think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings living with suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings living with suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. Okay. Thank you for your great compassion.
Thank you. Thank you so much.